Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The Iranians couldn't possibly even begin to try to develop a long-range missile until after 2015.
We'll hear the second half of our interview with journalist and historian Gareth Porter. He writes for Interpress Service News and other media outlets and is author of several books, including Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War in Vietnam. We'll also hear from writer and activist Jordan Flaherty, author of Floodlines, as he explains why one group is being called the WikiLeaks of New Orleans. And Taylor Asen joins us. He's with the Yale Law Veterans Clinic.
We really had no choice but to file a lawsuit and try to compel them to give us information about military sexual trauma.
He and other students at Yale Law School filed a lawsuit with the Connecticut and National ACLU and SWAN, the Service Women's Action Network. They're seeking records about military sexual abuse. Last time, Gareth Porter explained that New York Times reporters, including David Sanger, had ignored some key information about Iranian missile capabilities while reporting that Iran had acquired a long-range missile from North Korea that could be used to target Europe.
We already have our Judith Miller aluminum tube story, and that was the New York Times story of a couple of days ago.
David Sanger and former CIA Director Admiral James Woolsey were interviewed by NPR about this story. They were also asked to comment on their interpretation that the WikiLeaks cables showed that Gulf Arab states were worried enough about Iranian nuclear and missile technologies to want the U.S. to attack Iran.
Arab leaders from around the Persian Gulf were as concerned, if not more concerned, about the prospect of a nuclear Iran than, say, Israel is.
Iran is not known for its observance of international law, and it is entirely, I think, in the business of stalling while it works on its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs.
On December 6th in IPS News, Gareth Porter and Jim Loeb filled in crucial details about the WikiLeaks cables involving the Gulf Arab states. While the New York Times had led with the story described by Sanger and Woolsey that Gulf Arab leaders want to see the U.S. attack Iran, Gareth Porter and Jim Loeb found other WikiLeaks cables in the file, which detracted from that argument. They write, quote, "A careful reading of all the diplomatic cables reporting the views of Saudi and other Gulf Arab regimes on Iran shows that the Times account seriously distorted the content, and in the case of the Saudis, ignored the context of the cables released by WikiLeaks." Let's listen again to what New York Times reporter David Sanger told NPR listeners the WikiLeaks cables said, namely that Gulf Arab states want the U.S. to attack Iran.
Their biggest concern is that Iran would rise as the greatest power in the Middle East again.
Right.
And that's a challenge to the Saudis, to the Egyptians, to smaller countries like the UAE and Bahrain, all of whose leaders you hear from in these cables.
According to Gareth Porter and Jim Loeb, the WikiLeaks cables actually showed that the Gulf Arab states are seriously concerned about the consequences of a strike against Iran, that because of their own security. In fact, according to Porter and Loeb, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait have both expressed concern about an Iran attack with greater urgency in the past 2 years than previously.
We're having the same phenomenon of spectacular stories in the press, and again, it's the same newspaper, the New York Times, different author, but the same newspaper, pushing a line which coincides with the position of some people in the intelligence community, by no means all of them, and it's people in the intelligence community that have their own axe to grind who are pushing a line that is worst-case scenario. These are people who do not care about and are refusing to deal with the issue of intentions. The weapons people have never had any interest in the intentions of the Iranians. They simply assume the worst intentions and refuse to consider any alternative. And again, this is where the Russians were critical of the U.S. position.
Gareth Porter spoke with us by phone about his initial reports in late November debunking the New York Times and Washington Post stories. We asked him to go over the evidence they provided about a supposed Iranian BM-25 surface-to-surface missile they said was capable of hitting ranges at 2,400 to 4,000 kilometers. We asked Gareth Porter what was wrong with that part of their story.
First of all, I mean, nobody really has any idea of what the range of this missile is because the missile itself is so shadowy. You know, it's never been tested, so how could anybody possibly know what the actual range of it is? That's completely imaginary. I think the issue that was being discussed here of whether the Iranians might be able in the future to develop a missile that could reach Europe is one of whether they could extend the range of existing missile designs that they have begun to develop, they have tested. And here's where, you know, you have the Russians taking a very different position from the Americans. The Americans were using modeling studies to suggest that there were ways that they could, you know, lower the throw weight and, you know, increase the power of the engines and thus extend the range of existing missiles to 2,000 kilometers and perhaps beyond. And the Russians were saying, well, now, wait a minute. I mean, first of all, you know, when you extend the range like that, you have other consequences. You can have parts that would burn out. The missile could fall apart. And the Russians even suggested that it would become so inaccurate that it would become very dangerous. And so that was one of the constraints the Russians wanted the Americans to take into account. Another one was that the Russians said, look, the Iranians can put together a test with one missile. They can have a prototype, but they can't go ahead and produce these longer range missiles because they lack the aluminum that would be necessary to the high strength, high quality aluminum would be necessary to have this sort of missile. And this was another thing that the Americans had not considered. So the Russians were saying that there were a whole series of considerations, of technical barriers that the Americans were not taking into account. And the source at IISS, Michael Elliman, was saying the same thing, that the Americans were really taking, he said it was not a worst-case approach, but it was an approach of saying, well, here's what could possibly happen. The Russians were insisting that the analysis should be on the basis of what is really likely, what is really realistic.
You know, and it sounds like a contingency debate more so than one based on something more than a hypothetical here. I mean,
well, absolutely. They're talking about what might happen in future years, and the Russians are saying, look, the Iranians couldn't possibly even begin to try to develop a long-range missile until after 2015. The Americans are saying, well, we think they can get there much faster. They could even come out with a missile that could have a 2,000-kilometer range within the next couple of years. And the Russians were simply incredulous about that. They had two arguments. One was that they had seen this in the parade, which was in North Korea, if I understand it correctly, in May 2007. And there were reports that came out in the technical press claiming that this parade showed a long-distance intermediate-range missile coming forward for the first time. But the Russians said, look, we reviewed video of this parade and we came to the conclusion that this was not a clone, as they say, of the old obsolete RS-27, that is the submarine-launched missile, which supposedly the North Koreans based this missile on. So they were saying, we analyzed this in great detail and it's simply not the missile that people are saying it was. Then the second thing the U.S. was claiming was that they examined from satellite pictures the welding and design of the second stage of the Iranian missile that has most recently been tested, and that it bears resemblance to, it looks like it's using the same propellant combination as the old Russian submarine-launched missile. And the Russians refuted that as well, saying, first of all, you can't see well enough from satellite photographs to be able to measure distances, and that, in fact, the propellant combination in the Iranian missile, they are quite sure, is completely different from the propellant combination in the original Russian submarine-launched missile. So they refuted, technically, the American argument, and the Americans had nothing to come back on that with.
And so apparently there's other science here that comes into play too, and I don't understand the meaning of, you know, ratios of oxidizers to propellant.
It's simply a question of whether it is a clone, whether it's based on the Russian model, that is the Russian initial submarine-launched missile. And the Russians are saying, no, this is a different missile completely. That's all they're saying. It couldn't possibly be the BM-25 because it's not based on the Russian missile.
Okay. And finally, when you reviewed all of this data in one place, did you ask yourself what, if anything, other agencies within the UN, Security Council, other countries might have as a take on these so-called rockets that Iran does or does not have?
Not really, because I think, really, the Russians have undoubtedly the most expertise in analyzing this issue, and it requires a degree of knowledge of the Russian background of the missile in question to do this sort of analysis. The Russians were in the best position to put forward this kind of expert analysis of the question to go to let's say the Germans or the French or somebody like that, would be to go to somebody who's simply not nearly as well versed on the issues as the Russians are.
You say that the Russians have denied that Iran has intentions of developing even this rocket. They've argued that its ballistic missile program continues to be directed toward regional concerns, meaning they're more concerned about deterring an attack on Iran by Israel.
Right. I mean, this is a very interesting part of the Russian presentation, that they are not suspicious that Iran has some sort of a design on threatening Europe in order to somehow become a global hegemon or something like that, some outrageous notion of Iranian view of itself as a global dominant power. But rather, they take seriously what the Iranians themselves have said, which is that, no, I mean, we're only concerned with deterrence. And who do we have to deter? Well, it's essentially Israel. And that's the purpose of their missile force.
I guess it turns out to be a little bit like the problem of other countries recognizing the threat posed by global warming, as opposed to the way America has so politicized that whole discussion rather than taking action. Russia seems to have accepted the idea that they can live with a nuclear Iran under certain conditions. America has yet to face that, even that decision.
I think that you're right. It's really a matter of the United States continuing to stake out a position that is utterly unrealistic and is recognized as unrealistic by at least much of the rest of the world.
And is that the influence of the Israeli government? Let's just ask that question bluntly.
Well, I think that certainly the Obama administration is taking this position in large part because of the fear that departing from that position would expose it to the full wrath of not just the Israeli lobby, but all of those people in Congress who reflect the position of the Israeli lobby. And so I think that there is indeed a very significant veto that's being exercised by Israel over U.S. policy at this point.
We've had a story that began with revelations that Iran was farther along in its nuclear program, weapons program, than anyone thought before. Then we heard reports about the WikiLeaks, but it turns out that the information has been in the hands of some of these newspaper people for 6 months. Put those two things together. I mean, obviously, they've had plenty of time to get the context right and to get the nuances right.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no excuse for this kind of coverage. And of course, the Washington Post did not have access to the documents, nor did the New York Times initially. I mean, one has to be clear here that the WikiLeaks refused to give these documents, these diplomatic cables, to the New York Times, as they had previous rounds of WikiLeaks documents, because they recognized that the Times was going to inevitably distort them. But the Times then was able to get these documents from The Guardian. We don't know exactly when they did get them, The Guardian. Presumably it was a little bit later. We don't know how much time the Times did have to establish the context, as you put it. But I have no doubt that the Times were perfectly capable of being able to construct an accurate story here. Instead, what they did was to adjust the story to their own frame, which was a frame that was completely different from the actual contents of the document itself.
Do you think the media has missed the point to some extent about what the WikiLeaks documents really mean? You know, we've heard former CIA Director Woolsey on NPR talking about this, and, you know, he's very hawkish on the U.S. policy toward Iran. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia and actually one of the architects of the older U.S. policy toward countries in the Middle East. So shouldn't we be asking what U.S. policy during the Obama administration years should be toward such countries?
Well, I think that referring to the Saudi story and the story of other sheikhdoms in the Gulf and their attitude toward Iran and their urging the United States to attack Iran, again, raises the larger question of whether this represents accurately the full story of the viewpoint of Arab regimes in general and even the Gulf regimes in general. I think it's a more complicated story, clearly. This is one side of a much more complex picture in the Middle East, where you have not only differences within the regimes themselves. I mean, believe me, the viewpoint that has now been broadcast as representing the official view of the Saudi regime and other regimes is only one view of several views within those regimes, and that there are many officials at high levels in those regimes who believe that an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would be crazy, it would be the worst thing that could possibly happen to the Middle East and to their own countries and to their own regime. And I think that if there were a balanced coverage of this issue in terms of the diplomatic cables that were viewed and the interpretation of those cables, that a very different picture would emerge. And that's one of the ways in which I think WikiLeaks has made some misjudgments in terms of how this was done. I think that they failed to understand the way in which this would be played in terms of how the cables that were released would be treated. And I'm ready to say that I think it's time for WikiLeaks to really reassess, to reconsider its strategy in terms of the release of classified documents. I think that they need to now consider the possibility of cutting out the major commercial news media from this process and turn the documents over to alternative news media who have a very different way of approaching these issues and who do not have the kind of agenda which we've seen in play in the last few days and indeed in previous rounds as well. I think it's time for WikiLeaks to support alternative media, to give alternative media the documents, to give them some weeks to go over the documents before they are then published, and to withhold the documents themselves from the commercial news media until after the stories have been thoroughly aired by alternative news media. That's my proposal. I think it's worthwhile for WikiLeaks to consider the consequences of the strategy that they've used in the past.
Gareth Porter, are you going to be writing more about this topic?
Well, I'm thinking now, yes, about, in fact, writing something about the parallel here between this issue on the Russian refutation of the Iranian missile threat and the position apparently taken by some in the intelligence community with the aluminum tubes issue, and really drawing the parallel as a danger in the future to the U.S. In regard to Iran, that we are going down the same road that we went down in the case of WMD in Iraq because of the distorting factor of the way in which the U.S. intelligence community operates on these issues.
Gareth Porter is a scholar, investigative historian, and journalist on U.S. national security policy and especially the Middle East. His most recent book is Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. He has written extensively about security issues, one article after another also exposing the campaign of exaggerations and even direct deceptions on the part of both U.S. and Israeli governments and various reporters writing in support of hawkish policies toward Iran. You can find his work online at Interpress Service News, Huffington Post, Anti-War, and other sites. The founder of WikiLeaks has argued that the public has a right to know what officials talk about. Many people agree, but it's a debate that also has state and local officials concerned in places like Connecticut and Louisiana. In Connecticut, Hartford Current writer John Lender has been following a controversial story about Republican Governor Jody Rell, who wants to have as many as 161 emails going back 5 years destroyed. State Librarian Kendall Wiggin told John Lender that the emails will be, quote, erased, deleted, or otherwise destroyed after 60 days. In another Connecticut story, Yale law students are working together with the ACLU to obtain records on the numbers of women who have been victims of sexual trauma while serving in the military. Those records could be used to help members of Congress write new legislation they hope would protect the rights of women.
One reason that we've sent in these FOIA requests and now we're bringing this lawsuit, because the public has a right to know. This is our military.
Joining us now is Taylor Asen. He's with the Yale Law Veterans Clinic. And Taylor Asen, just tell us what the general gist is of this case and how you got to be involved in it.
Sure. I'm a law student at Yale, like you mentioned, and a member of the Veterans Clinic. And we were representing SWAN, which is the Service Women's Action Network, which is an advocacy group that works on women's issues in the military. And we met with them, and they do a lot of work on military sexual trauma, and they wanted us to help them get information from the federal government about the extent of the MST crisis in the military and what the government is doing about it. So we partnered with the ACLU and the ACLU of Connecticut, who are requesters in this case, along with SWAN, and we sent FOIA requests, which are the Freedom of Information Act requests, to the government asking for information. And the government has not been forthcoming. So we really had no choice but to file a lawsuit and try to compel them to give us information about military sexual trauma. More specifically, the lawsuit asked for information about what the government is doing to curb military sexual trauma, how the government is adjudicating these cases in which people have been accused of rape and sexual harassment, and the amount of benefits the government is giving to women and some men, too, who suffer military sexual trauma and have severe post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's the scope of what the documents we're asking for.
We had a guest in Connecticut at Eastern Connecticut State University last September, Dar Jamail, and he's author of the book Will to Resist. In that book, there is a lot about women's sexual trauma, you know, and things that happen in the military. They call it MST, military sexual trauma.
Right.
Apparently, it's happening nearly twice as often within military ranks as within civilian society. Now, what I'd like to ask you, though, is when Dar was here, you know, he told the audience, very large group of young people, students, that this was going on, and they seemed shocked. And, you know, yet it had been going on for long enough for him to document quite a bit in his book.
I mean, I joined this clinic because I'm interested in military and veterans issues. I think they're really important issues, and, you know, there's a lot of veterans issues we don't talk about enough. But when I learned more about military sexual trauma, I was totally shocked. And I think it's true that it is documented in places, but the full magnitude of the crisis is not really in the public sphere. And that's one reason that we've sent in these FOIA requests and now we're bringing this lawsuit, because the public has a right to know. This is our military. And like you said, the amount of rape and sexual harassment that goes on in the military is completely unconscionable in the 21st century. And this is our military, and we have a right to know what's going on in it. And ultimately, the taxpayers are going to have to bear the burden of taking care of all these people who are suffering post-traumatic stress disorder from the enormous amount of rape that goes on in the military. And I think maybe the worst part is not even just the amount of rape and sexual harassment, but the fact that a lot of the people who are perpetrating these crimes are not being punished. That's really maybe the worst part of the scandal.
And is that tied in with not being able to get these records? Because I know, you know, some of the listeners may wonder about the rights of women to not have some of these records known. And yet, if they don't get them, Congress can't make new legislation very well, and the public
right.
doesn't know the scale of the problem.
Well, we're not asking for specific names or anything like that. I mean, that's going to be protected. What we want to know is just the magnitude of the problem exactly. I think SWAN and ACLU have some sense of the problem, but really, until the military is more forthcoming, we can't, until we really know the scale of the problem, I think it's going to be hard for the legislature to know what exactly needs to be done. And I do think if the military releases a lot of these records, there's going to be a public outcry, and the legislature's going to really have to take a step back and think, you know, maybe the procedures we have in place now to handle these matters is not appropriate. And maybe there needs to be a little more oversight of the military in the way they handle these matters.
Taylor Asen, what year are you at Yale Law?
I'm a second-year student.
Do you hope to stick with these kinds of issues as you graduate and then go into practice?
I'm going to do some sort of public interest law, and I'm not sure what. There's no question in my mind that I'll be doing this work until I leave. Working on these veterans' issues has been the best thing I've done at law school. It's been incredible. And, you know, it's been a great honor to work on veterans because, you know, frankly, this is a group of people who really need a lot of help and who are not getting it. It's a group of very needy people who slip through the cracks for whatever reason. And, yeah, it's been absolutely great. I'm proud to do it.
Taylor Aysen, again, with Yale Law Veterans Clinic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Next time, we'll hear from Jordan Flaherty about his book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Genesix. When we spoke with him, he mentioned one of the groups described in his book, saying it could be called the WikiLeaks of Louisiana. The group filed a Freedom of Information Act request to obtain the emails of former New Orleans City Councilwoman Stacey Head. The emails she eventually did release indicated she had a low regard for poor people and joked about their not being able to properly buy their own food. She also complained about funding to the poor for that reason.
Stacey Head was that city council member who had the information about her release, and it was done by an organization that I've also collaborated with called Louisiana Justice Institute. In many ways, they're like the WikiLeaks of New Orleans, who have helped these stories to get out through Freedom of Information Act requests, helped to release these public documents and give people of New Orleans insight to how their political leaders and these organizations are actually functioning. And it's been so crucial that these stories have come out.
The significance of giving voters all of the information they need to elect good political candidates can't be overstated when it comes to a city like New Orleans, still trying to recover from Hurricane Katrina. I asked Jordan Flaherty about that aspect of what's in his book Floodlines, and how he describes the challenges to return New Orleans to some semblance of the political landscape people had created before the storm.
Well, the issue of civic representation is a very contentious one in the city. In this post-Katrina period, you know, you've gone from 30 years of a black mayor in a 70% African-American city to now a white mayor, 30 years of a majority black city council to now five white city council members and two African-American city council members. Went from a black district attorney to a white district attorney, black police chief to white police chief. So you've had a feeling among African-Americans that this post-Katrina period has been also partly a period of their civic representation being taken from them. And certainly, you know, as they say, it's a smaller city, it's a whiter city, it's a wealthier city. You know, these changes have happened, and I think the 100,000 or more New Orleanians that are still displaced but want to come home are the ones whose voices are really not being felt in these elections, and who really feel that they've been robbed of civic representation. And so it's challenging. And, you know, if you look at the international law that governs disasters, the International Covenant on the Rights of Internally Displaced People, it talks about people not just having a right to return, but a right to have a stay in their reconstruction. And, you know, that's something that people have really been robbed of. And instead, disasters in the U.S. are governed under the Robert T. Stafford Act, which in many ways lays out the rights that people recovering from disasters don't have. And people from New Orleans, like the organization Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, led by Monique Hardin and Natalie Walker, have really been leading the struggle to say, let's look at international law and the ways in which what's happened in the post-Katrina period has been a violation of international law.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. TalkNationRadio@gmail.com if you'd like to write to us.